to bore you people. All right. We have a lot of breaking developments here. Just as we're coming on the air, Judy has been trying to keep us apprised of everything that is happening. Street closures. Stay close with us if you are anywhere in the city. We'll let you know what's happening on the streets as it occurs. Right now, it appears that there are sporadic and relatively small protests and peaceful.
Yeah.
Thus far.
Absolutely.
Going up and down a few of the streets in downtown Chicago. Right now, I believe on Wabash in the south of Madison. So we will we'll see what transpires there. That looks to be Wabash and Monroe. So we will keep an eye on those things. Also, talk to all the principals here. We're expecting that Dan Herbert, who is the attorney for Jason Van Dyke, is going to be joining us here in just a moment and get his immediate reaction to the verdict. Again, Jason Van Dyke convicted on second-degree murder. Now, let's explain a little bit about what that actually means here, because that's a significant difference between first-degree and second-degree murder. Second-degree murder, a lot of people would call it manslaughter. And this carries with it a 4 to 20 year sentence. But it is also probationable, depending on the judge. The judge could decide that he doesn't want a sentence, and he could just sentence the anybody who's convicted of it to probation if he determines that there are mitigating enough factors to do so.
Right. You're also eligible for parole and eligible for time for good behavior, which wouldn't have been available for murder one, but it's the 16 counts of aggravated battery, one for each shot, that carry with it a 6 years minimum for those counts. Potentially, they could run concurrent. You'd have to see what Judge Gahan decides to do with that, but that seems to be real time connected to those.
As Mike Monaco had been telling us for the last couple of days here, he's joining us right now on the phone, that the aggravated battery charges are really the ones that create a sentencing structure for the judge here. It's a minimum of 6 years that he would have to sentence, and there are 16 counts of this, which will be considered concurrently, I would imagine, because it's based on a single predicate, a single act. Is that right?
I would imagine so. I mean, I heard you talking earlier that you're right. They may charge, with the voluntary manslaughter, it's 4 to 20 years, but it is probationable. These 16 counts are not probationable, and it's a Class X felony, and Class X you have to do about 85%. So it's a very tough verdict for the defendant here.
And he was not on electronic monitoring prior, so he's not eligible for any time served because he was out on bond prior to the trial. There were some legal experts who were arguing that they should put him in and then put him on electronic monitoring, which would then reduce his sentence after a potential conviction here, but that was not the case. So
I'm not sure you do get credit for that, frankly.
All right, so at this point, the judge, some of the analysis I've heard thus far today, as I've been talking to people in the criminal justice system, both in the prosecutorial and judicial side of this, so assume that it's going to be, the judge is going to give Van Dyke at least 6 years on one of the charges, on one of the aggravated battery charges. But then when it comes to the second-degree murder, the prosecution can ask for up to 20 years on that. But that is served at 50% time in Illinois. Right. So the judge could agree on a number around 15 years for second-degree murder, which would put him in prison for about 7.5 years, which would eat up all of his aggravated battery time, and then still make him eligible for parole before he's 50 years old.
You know, and this is the explanation of all this is interesting, but this is something the jury doesn't know, of course. Mm-hmm. In Illinois and in federal court system, the juries are not told what the sentences are. Some states they are. Some states even have something to do with selecting sentences. And it's interesting in Illinois that the juries have no idea what the sentences are. The only time they get to know what the sentences are is if the state calls a witness who gets some kind of break, and then the defense lawyers can ask, well, you're missing. You will not have to serve 6 to 30 years for aggravated battery because you are have the benefit of talking to the you're getting the government's service here, the state service here.
Mike,
so it's
I want to ask you about something here. Dan Herbert, the defense attorney for Officer Jason Van Dyke, said, I know we're going to be speaking with him in a little bit, but he said the family of Jason Van Dyke feels a sense of relief because, quote, this could have been a death sentence for him. I'm assuming he's talking about first-degree murder. What that might mean.
Hold on one second. Can I interrupt you for a second here? Because we have the jurors now speaking.
Your thoughts about the deliberations and how you came to this verdict?
The deliberations were, I think they couldn't have been better because we listened to each other. We respected what each other said. When somebody was questioning something, we let them ask their questions, and we worked with it until we all came to a consensus. And when that consensus was made, we all realized we'd made the right decision.
And how did you go about that? Did you deal with the murder charge first and then aggravated battery?
We started with the murder first, and we had a little problem at first, but we talked about it.
What was the problem?
We wanted to decide whether we're going to go first degree or second. So, but we had to break everything down, and we talked among each other until we came to the conclusion.
What was the key factor in deciding on the second degree versus first degree?
You want to answer that one?
The second degree was a mitigating factor. That in Mr. Van Dyke's mind, he was doing the right thing. He was experiencing an extreme threat. In his mind, that's how he's experiencing it. And he felt like he needed to protect himself.
Now, you convicted on second degree and all of the aggravated battery counts, but not official misconduct. Why?
Because we felt he had the right to carry the weapon, and he had the right to use this weapon because he was a police officer. So he had that right. So we had to say not guilty on that if you looked at the case.
What about you? How would you explain that, sir?
I'm remembering the sequence, and I'm a little unclear about my memories. I would need to be refreshed, as they say in court. So I'll pass on that.
And just to go back to, you said you kind of looked at the first degree and second degree murder charges first. Mm-hmm. How quickly did you arrive at that? Was that something you had kind of looked at last night?
We went over it last night, but we made no decisions last night. Everybody talked about it, and we couldn't come to a decision on last night, so we said we'll start fresh tomorrow.
So it was this morning that you came to that, and then you moved on to the other charges?
Yes.
It seems the way you're talking that the question was to convict on first or second. Was an acquittal ever on the table? Did anyone come in the room saying, I don't think he's guilty at all?
No.
Really? That was never an option in any of the jurors' minds?
No.
Sir, you mentioned that you believe that he thought the threat was real. Did that play into possibly acquitting him of the charges?
No, we realized that as a police officer, a trained officer who'd been doing his work for about 20 years, that he should have realized what the situation was, and instead of escalating the situation, should have at least looked at other options. For example, just taking the time to back away or just the patience to wait for other vehicles to get there, a vehicle with a taser specifically. That instead of escalating the situation, he should have de-escalated.
Was there any piece of evidence that helped you with that decision? There were a lot of videos shown. How did that play into your decision?
Well, we kept watching the video where it showed that he kept making the steps forward.
Was that the animation or the dash cam video?
The dash cam. We watched that more than once, than three times, really.
The dash cam.
What was the most important evidence or witness did you encountered here that helped you make a decision? What was the most important, or what was the most important in making up your mind?
I would say Dr. Arupamar, was that her name? The coroner, the medical examiner. Her.
And why?
Because she broke down every bullet, what it did, how it went in, which way it went in, how it came out. Or did it come out?
There was another pathologist that the defense put on the stand. What did you make of her?
Really didn't care for her. I thought she was kind of cocky. She didn't listen. She wanted to overtalk people.
And just the defense's argument in general, that he made the best decision that he could in a difficult time. How are your feelings about the defense's arguments?
I don't feel it was the best decision. He was a trained professional of 20 years. To me, he should have thought more carefully about the situation and the time in which that he got out of the car before he started shooting.
Sir, you look like you had something to say there.
No, basically the same thing. It's like he needed to contain the situation, not escalate it.
He took the stand himself. What did you make of his... Okay, go ahead.
I felt he shouldn't have. He messed up.
How?
His testimony was incredible to me. I felt like he was trying to remember stuff that he said that maybe wasn't true, and he wanted to make sure he didn't trip himself up. So I didn't really feel his testimony was credible.
Same.
Two.
Right, same. I didn't think he should have testified because he kept going from one question and he would answer this question, then he would go back, and then he act like he didn't remember. He only remembered what he wanted to.
It felt like it was a rehearsed situation. And I didn't quite trust that.
And I know you were sequestered and not supposed to watch anything, but did any of you realize this was such a high-profile case, or how did you feel about being on such a high-profile case?
I had no idea that it was like this. I knew that we weren't supposed to talk to anyone, but to be escorted out and police patrol.
We appreciate the safety we had with the sheriff. They did a good job protecting us every day.
A little more than I expected.
Mm-hmm. But what did you think about being on this case?
It was interesting. It'll be something that I'll talk about for a while.
Mm-hmm. Every morning I got on the bus and on the train, and I saw hundreds and hundreds of my fellow Chicagoans, and I thought, how did I get on this jury?
Right.
There are all these people, and I'm doing this work, and nobody knows it. It felt really amazing.
It felt like a burden or a privilege?
A privilege.
Privilege.
Mm-hmm. I almost threw my jury paper in the garbage, though, because I wasn't coming.
What do you want to say about jury service?
It's the United States is really the only country that used the jury system. So I felt privileged after I got here.
And there was concern by some outside, you probably didn't know because you weren't watching any news, but there was some concern about the jury makeup and the lack of diversity of the jurors. What would any of you say about jury service and whether you felt race or ethnicity played into this case?
I don't feel that it did until the end. The statement that was made at the end was wrong to me. The Boy Scout statement. I just didn't feel that was appropriate.
And this was Dan Herbert, the defense attorney.
I felt that was really inappropriate. We're past all of that. We didn't come here because of race. We came here for right and wrong. That's all.
Did you guys consider the impact of what your decision was going to be outside the courtroom? Reaction among the public for
a guilty verdict? I do, because I work in City Hall. So I just think about when I go back to work how many people's going to approach me. because in the newspaper they told where I work, so everybody already at my job knew that it was me. So
would you consider the idea of taking reactions or whatever verdict you're under?
I did not consider that. I was aware of it. But it's like, we're here to do this job with what the law is and what the prosecution and defense says. And I knew that was my job, and that's where I kept my focus.
All right, we're listening to the jurors here who have just told us basically all the stuff about the case. It's pretty fascinating. We'll get more legal analysis from Mike Monaco, go through some of the things that were said there, and go. Interesting, though, I think the prosecution came across as credible. The defense in this case, according to the jurors, was less. It wasn't so much the credibility issue, although they didn't think Jason Van Dyke seemed credible when he took the stand. But they didn't like. At one point, one of the defense witnesses, the professional medical examiner who was called in, the private medical examiner was called in. One of the jurors referred to her as cocky. And didn't like when Dan Herbert, in his closing argument, used the term Boy Scout.
That was an interesting, a very controversial moment.
When he said, Laquan McDonald's not a Boy Scout. And one of the jurors, the African-American woman, thought that was seemed to have a racial tinge to it. All right, we'll get back to this. We'll get more analysis. Again, the case of Jason Van Dyke has been settled now in a guilty of murder in the second degree and 16 counts now guilty of aggravated battery, which is really the significant part of the sentence when you talk to legal analysts about the sentencing here. We'll talk about all of that, but first let's check in the roadways here. Violetta's going to get us caught up.
Then there's this week on Chicago's Best, a pineapple stuffed with seafood and topped with melted cheese. You have to see it to believe it. Chicago's Best Seafood, Sunday night at 10, WGN-TV.
Toni Preckwinkle is joining us. She's the county board president and also might want to be mayor of the city of Chicago. Mm-hmm. We'll your reaction to the verdict here in the Jason Van Dyke trial.
Well, you know, nothing can make up for the loss of Laquan McDonald's life, but I'm grateful that there's some justice for him today. Like many people, I saw the video and was devastated by it, and my heart goes out to his family and friends. No, I think it's important to understand that not only was Jason Van Dyke convicted today, but, you know, what's been called to attention is the code of silence in the police department. Three of his fellow officers will subsequently be tried for obstruction of justice around what happened that night. So, you know, this isn't the end of it, but I am very grateful to the jurors who came to this decision.
Toni, first Chicago police officer half a century to be found guilty of murder for an on-duty shooting. Do you think this is a turning point for this city?
Yes, I definitely do. But I would point out that, you know, over the last several months, Kim Fox, our state's attorney, has also had mass exonerations of young men who were coerced into or tortured into confessions. So I think there are a number of things happening, not just this verdict, but a number of things happening that I think indicate that we have the possibility of making change in police community relations. And I would again express my appreciation to the jurors and to Kim Fox and the state's attorney's office for recognizing that we've had pattern and practice of rogue cops getting away with framing people for crimes they didn't commit. And acknowledging that, I think, is the first step toward healing.
What about the other side of that equation, though, for police officers who find themselves in dangerous situations with armed suspects? Are you concerned that they are going to hesitate to do their job?
No. You have to understand that this is the first time in 50 years that an officer has been found guilty of an on-duty murder. So I think it's a very rare occurrence. And our police officers on the street, as I said, struggle every day to do a difficult job well, and we're grateful to them.
All right. Toni Preckwinkle, thank you very much.
Thank you, Toni.
Appreciate it. All right. Let's check in with Judy Pilak. She's got the WGN News right now.
Look, I do believe blame some of the politicians. I think that over the last several years, they have used this case, one case, and I want to remind everybody, we answer millions of calls every year, and they have used this case to really kick around the Chicago Police Department, which has been unfortunate.
That's Kevin Graham. He is a Fraternal Order of Police president here for the lodge that represents the Chicago Police Department, and Bill Daley is joining us now. We're getting his reaction. Bill Daley, of course, former Commerce Secretary, and says he wants to run for mayor. I read
you
something
about
that, Bill.
I
did try to talk him out of it, but apparently to no avail. All right, so first of all, your reaction.
Look, this has been obviously a tragic and a rather painful episode for our city. The last years have been very difficult for the police department, for the victim's family, the police officer's family, but justice has been served and justice worked, and we ought to acknowledge that. We ought to start to do the healing and bringing together this city that has to be done between the community, the police department, and hopefully learn some lessons from this tragedy and try to move on together, not divided.
You've heard some of the police response to this bill. You saw the FOP president potentially,
right,
Dan Herbert, and other police officers speaking out saying that this is going to have a chilling effect on the way they may be arriving at scenes, and they may wait in their cars, what Herbert said. We may wait to see if a person gets tired or, God forbid, kills someone before we act. What do you think when you hear that that's how police officers are viewing this verdict?
I don't know if that lawyer's perception is the way police officers are viewing it. I think we ought to watch our rhetoric. One should not speak on behalf of incidents that haven't taken place. To think police officers would sit in their cars and wait for someone to kill someone to react is absolutely ludicrous. Obviously, the jury felt that this police officer in this case reacted in an inappropriate way to a threat that they felt, obviously, from their decision wasn't there. So I think we ought to all watch our rhetoric. I get the statement of the police union. I don't know if that necessarily
reflects. That was pretty strong, too, Bill. He said
I get that the union representative says that. I don't know if that's necessarily reflective of all police officers in the city who go about their job. This was an incident of an individual who acted. None of the other police officers who were next to him or around him reacted in the same way. So in many ways, this was an individual's actions that took the life of Mr. McDonald. So I think leaders have got to watch their rhetoric at this time. They've got to comment. Obviously, lawyer's job is to represent his client. I get that. And the union head's job is to represent the union. But I think that we all ought to be careful about making too many assumptions about the professionalism of the Chicago Police Department and the men and women of the police department and how they react to certain situations.
All right, Bill Daley, thank you very much. Appreciate
your
time.
Thank you.
All right, Mike Monaco is back with us, our legal analyst. And you did hear what the jury said, Mike. When they came out of their, three of the jurors came out to speak to the press, and they said they never ever considered an acquittal. Are you surprised by that?
That'll be another thing that the defense will raise on appeal. It's always problematic. Now, a juror cannot, the law is that afterwards, when you talk to a juror after he reached a decision, a juror cannot undermine the decision that he made or she made. So ordinarily the statements made after the fact can't be used on appeal, but I'm sure they're going to try to. One of the things she said, or they said today, was that they did not believe the defendant when he testified, Van Dyke. Now, I've often thought, and lawyers often think, if you put a defendant on in a criminal case, all the other evidence is meaningless. The only thing that the jury is going to concern about is, did they believe the defendant when he testified or not?
Okay, well, let's say, hold on. We have the juror responding exactly to that.
I felt he shouldn't have. He messed up.
How?
His testimony was incredible to me. I felt like he was trying to remember stuff that he said that maybe wasn't true. And he wanted to make sure he didn't trip himself up. So I didn't really feel his testimony was credible.
Okay.
So that's the problem with putting your defendant on.
Well, and that's what they said. Even the jurors spoke to that. What you've talked to us about is that he shouldn't have taken the stand. They thought it was the wrong thing, that he didn't help himself. In fact, he hurt himself. They didn't believe a thing he said, it sounded like.
It sounded that way. And this is something that defense lawyers think about. There's only really two decisions you make as a defense lawyer: bench or jury. Does the defendant testify or not? And you often think if the defendant testifies, the case comes down to does the jury believe him or her?
One of the other things that came up from the jury here was the use of the word Boy Scout. In Dan Herbert's closing argument to the jury, the defense attorney, he said Laquan McDonald was not a Boy Scout. Here's how this one juror reacted.
I don't feel that it did until the end. The statement that was made at the end was wrong to me. The Boy Scout statement. I just didn't feel that was appropriate.
He said if he shot a Boy Scout with a knife walking down the street, then that wouldn't have been justified. But Laquan McDonald was no Boy Scout.
Right. And that the predicating question there was, did race play a role
was
here?
Race a,
and that's
that
and she
case.
Started
and,
that.
She when said she, not until that.
Not until that.
And it's, you know, these are very, very tough cases. The process, as we talked about, the defense wanted to bring out the fact that the victim, Laquan McDonald, had a criminal history. And they wanted to bring that out for a lot of reasons, you know, that they thought would help the defendant in his case. But the jury didn't believe it. The jury didn't really use that against him, Laquan McDonald, because most of the things, or I guess all of the things, the defendant had no idea about. Van Dyke had no idea about this particular victim's criminal history.
One of the other interesting moments here, too, was that as the jury was considering this, there was the issue of de-escalation. And why did he shoot as opposed to waiting? And when he did shoot, he moved forward. Now, this was a big piece of the case, that Jason Van Dyke, when leaving his car, he kept moving toward Laquan McDonald as Laquan McDonald was moving toward him. And therefore, as he was moving forward, he was shooting. And after he started shooting, he continued to move forward, even though in the police report and from the stand, Jason Van Dyke said that he thought he was moving backwards as opposed to forward. But the video obviously showed a different story, and that seemed to be very compelling for this jury.
Right. There is very few cases you actually have the video of the crime. Here you have a video of the crime, the video of the policeman shooting Laquan McDonald. We know what happened. We know what it was. And it's because it conflicted with what Van Dyke was talking about, and it's part of his defense, that didn't help him.
Okay. All right. Mike, we'll check in with you a little bit later on this afternoon. I know you're on assignment right now.
Yes, I am.
As the past president of an organization that you're speaking at tonight. So we're going to ask you to jump back on with us in just a little bit, but appreciate your time. Sir,
thanks,
Mike Monaco, our legal
My pleasure.
Analyst and one of the most esteemed trial lawyers in America, who joins us here regularly on the Rocon Show with Ann DeVantis on 720 WGN. Let's check in with Judy, find out what else is coming up at the top of the hour.
And I'm looking up, and I'm thinking that that's the special prosecutor speaking, if you want to go to that.
Yes, I indeed do. Thank you very much, Judy. This is the special prosecutor, King County prosecutor, who
dedication prosecuted that they put this into case. Their professionalism, their perspectives, their different thoughts, the very strong conversations that we had from the day that we were appointed on this case. That brought really different perspectives to how we were going to put our trial strategy together, and most importantly, their integrity at every step of the way. I also want to thank the Winnebago County State's Attorney, Joe Briscato, and that entire office for allowing us to work with Marilyn Hite Ross. Also, my staff back in the office in Kane, everyone there took on extra tasks, extra responsibility. They worked extra hours on their own time. We filled in the gaps to make sure that justice in Kane County didn't miss a beat and the people of Kane County continued to be served well. Also, the court personnel here in the Layton Criminal Courts building here in Cook County, from the day we walked in here, August 4th, 2016, they welcomed us. They treated us like old friends, and I appreciate that courtesy and what I know my entire team considers new and just really nice friendships. I also want to thank the Cook County State's Attorney's Office, both the current State's Attorney Kim Fox and the prior State's Attorney Anita Alvarez, to ensure that this case had a seamless transition from the Cook County State's Attorney's Office to my office. They both made a commitment that justice would be served in this case, and the investigation and the prosecution, there would be no gap in that case. Also, the Cook County Sheriff's Office, the way they looked out for us, the way they took care of us, not just my team and my office, but really all the parties involved in this case. I also want to thank my colleagues in the federal system, both John Lish, the U.S. Attorney, Joel Levine, who was the acting U.S. Attorney, and Zach Farden, the U.S. Attorney before them. My team has met with their office and each of them personally a number of times to make sure that the investigation that started very soon after the events of October 20, 2014 came together in what I think has been a successful prosecution. And then finally, people I want to thank, the people of Kane County and Winnebago counties, for recognizing the importance of this case and for giving us the freedom to tackle this case with the attention and the energy it deserved. So let me talk about this case here. This is a gratifying verdict. We are all pleased that we have been successful in our pursuit for justice for Laquan McDonald, for his mother, Tina, and for their family and friends. But a guilty verdict doesn't undo a crime. This verdict holds Jason Van Dyke accountable for his actions. It provides some justice for Laquan McDonald and Tina, for Laquan's family and friends, and it provides validation and a sense of justice for many residents of Chicago and Cook County. And beyond this area, for many communities, the African-American community across our country. But we all know that this verdict does not bring back Laquan McDonald. We have kept our focus on the actions of Jason Van Dyke the night of October 20th, 2014. And although we all live 30, 40 miles west of here, we don't live in a vacuum. We are aware of the concerns of the urban community, especially here in Chicago, but also in our hometowns of Elgin and Rockford and Aurora, Illinois. The end of this trial marks an opportunity for this city to come together. This investigation, this criminal prosecution of Jason Van Dyke, I believe reflects our shared values and has been the result of people simply doing the right thing. A Hispanic man and his son who came forward to tell the truth. Police officers who remembered that their duty is to serve and protect all of us. A justice system that has worked for the community, and an African-American community that demanded justice for Laquan McDonald and all those people he represented. The words liberty and justice for all, words we teach our children in the Pledge of Allegiance, have meaning. They mean what they say, and they say all that is needed. Those of us who work in law enforcement and work to uphold the rule of law know that unless people come forward to tell the truth, our court system will break down. The people of Illinois, the people of Cook County, and the city of Chicago owe a debt of gratitude to the citizens who spoke up and stepped forward to tell the truth. They were colorblind. And today our justice system fulfilled its obligation of justice for all. Robert Kennedy said about 50 years ago that each time a man or a woman stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustice, that he or she sends forth a tiny ripple of hope. One of our goals in accepting this appointment was to live those words and show through our actions that our criminal justice system does stand up and apply laws equally without regard to an individual's status, that it excludes no one, particularly those who live in society's margins.
That's Cheswick McMahon. He is the King County prosecutor, but brought in as a special prosecutor here in Cook County to prosecute the case against Jason Van Dyke. And again, Jason Van Dyke found guilty of second-degree murder and 16 counts of aggravated battery. All of that happening just within the last hour and a half at the Layton Criminal Courts Building at 26th and California here in Chicago. We will continue here. Let's check in with Violetta because traffic is snarled downtown as protesters were told were trying to get from Wabash to Michigan Avenue at Monroe and may have succeeded now. Concho with Anna DeBlantis right here on 720 WGN. We have more legal analysis. Pat Brady is joining us. Political and legal analysis. He wears two hats, and he wears them nice? Quite well. Mm-hmm. All right. First, let's go out onto the street here where the protest is going. Our own Ryan Burrow is with the protesters. Ryan, where are you?
I'm right at Monroe and Michigan Avenue right now, and you can probably hear him chanting, "Let us through." This protest has kind of meandered through the loop, and now we're at this point where the police will not let these demonstrators, and literally hundreds of them, across onto Michigan Avenue. And we've been kind of at a standstill for about 10, 15 minutes at this point. Doesn't look like police are backing off, and we're not seeing traffic stopping on Michigan Avenue right now. So it looks like the option is either to continue chanting at police or turn around and maybe head back into the loop.
So Jason Van Dyke has been found guilty of second-degree murder and 16 counts of aggravated battery. Are the protesters celebrating or still protesting something?
It's a mix. Yeah, there were celebrations. There were cheers. I was outside of City Hall when the announcement came, and it was a roar in front of the crowd. And since that time, more and more people have gathered out here. They're very satisfied. Some say they wish he would have gotten first-degree murder, but seem to be satisfied with at least second-degree murder. Now they're talking about other injustices, other names that have been brought up of African-Americans who they feel have been wronged in one form or another, either by the city or by the police department. And many of the leaders have told me personally that this is just the beginning and these demonstrations are going to continue, especially as we get into election season.
All right, stay with it, and we'll check back with you in a little bit. But still being held. What are they chanting right now?
They're saying, "Who do you send?" You know what? We're seeing some movement here, guys. Stick with me for a second. They are opening it up. Violetta, we are now entering Michigan Avenue. So this just happened right now. They are allowing these demonstrators to move eastbound on Monroe across Michigan Avenue.
Are they going across Michigan Avenue, or are they going on Michigan Avenue and then northbound?
Right now we're going across. We are headed eastbound on Michigan Avenue. You can probably hear them chanting, "The people united will never be defeated." They have halted traffic completely. And, yep, it looks like we're continuing to move eastward, but I don't know what's going to happen at this point. We've seen some of these demonstrators kind of sit and hold their place, and this might be an opportunity for them to do that and really clog up traffic for quite some time.
How many would you say there are? I know that's always hard to estimate crowds, but if you just people who can't don't have the beauty of the visual, how many people are you talking?
It really is. I'd say hundreds. I mean, I don't have the advantage of a helicopter view, but yeah, I mean, it's built steadily since the announcement. We started with a few dozen demonstrators outside of City Hall at the beginning, and now easily 200, maybe 300 that I've noticed at this.
Certainly enough to shut down Michigan Avenue.
Okay, so we are now turning left, and we are heading north in the northbound lanes of Michigan Avenue.
And what are police following them with? Are they on horses, bikes, walking?
So flanking the outsides is the bike police. And, they use those bikes as kind of a barricade to keep people in a certain area. Immediately behind the end of the demonstration are multiple squad cars. So they're just kind of tailing the back end of it. But as far as the front goes, what happens is the demonstrators kind of push to a point, and then when police decide to fall back, as they just did, they kind of break apart, dissolve. 12, and then they set up wherever the next barrier is, wherever they want to keep people in that direction. Now, I'm probably about two-thirds of the way back, so I don't see where the head of this is going if they plan to continue this march. My guess, just based on previous marches, is this will probably end up crossing the river at some point.
All right, our own Domiti Pongo is actually now at Michigan and Wacker. We're going to check in with him in just a moment and find out as he's standing there. You at Monroe are about five blocks further south than the river. So he's stationed at the river to see what preparations police are making there. Often police want to start to corral protesters or then redirect them and maybe circle them around back down Wacker or someplace even further south than that.
Yeah, we're approaching Madison now. We're not walking through traffic, so they must have stopped the northbound traffic at some point, which is obviously good news. Southbound traffic is pretty much at a standstill right now, including many buses.
All right. Let's see. Domiti Pongo is going to join us as well on the phone here. Domiti, are you on Michigan Avenue now?
Yeah, I'm right here at Michigan and Randolph. I'm walking south on Michigan.
Do you see the protesters?
And I see that. Yeah, in the distance, the crowd is massive, bro.
And in terms of police activity now, are police creating a straight passage here for the protesters as they're moving north on Michigan Avenue?
There are about 20 police officers on bikes right now riding north on Michigan Avenue ahead of the protesters. So right now meeting me are five officers on bikes, a few yards behind them, another dozen or so, and then probably another six or so behind them. And then several blocks back, you see the protesters. So it looks like they're clearing the path for them to be able to march north in those lanes northbound on Michigan Avenue.
Domiti, right. We hear them chanting. From what you can tell, is it all seem very peaceful and just chanting and rallying and a peaceful sign of a protest there?
It's a strange juxtaposition, Anna. From my point of view, you see not only the field of protesters way, way back where Ryan is, but then you have tourists and just folks walking down Michigan Avenue minding their business who aren't part of the protest, but just a sea of people. So they definitely don't seem to be intimidating people who are just downtown jogging, walking, or tourists walking around. They're just on the sidewalk walking right past the protesters, and the protesters take up the whole middle of the street right here on Michigan Avenue. And I'm getting very close to them right here now. There's a police vehicle, an SUV, with their lights on, making sure that cars don't hurt the protesters, actually here at, what is this, Washington, right across from Millennium Park.
All right, let me check in with Ryan Burrow as well here. Ryan, you're back about four blocks in this, or three blocks.
Well, I'm up to Madison now, so I'm coming up to Domiti, and this is kind of the center, and you can tell that based on where the signs are and kind of where the TV cameras are. This is where they want to be, have that best shot. But, yeah, we've seen demonstrations, especially with the Laquan McDonald case, come up and down Michigan Avenue before, and it does snarl traffic. And on a Friday in this city, you know, obviously that's a problem. Now, the one thing I can tell you is this city, just prior to the announcement of the verdict, was starting to become a ghost town. A lot of the buildings were shutting down. I was in the Thompson Center, and a state trooper came around, told everyone to get out before 2 o'clock. They were closing the building down. So hopefully a lot of the people were out of these buildings and, you know, as a result, probably won't feel the effects of this and the traffic snarls. But, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of visitors who weren't expecting that here this weekend.
All right. We'll check back in with you in a few minutes here. Thank you, Ryan. Appreciate it. That's Ryan Burrow, who's covering this for us from Michigan Avenue, where there is a protest. Seems like it's the only organized protest at this moment. Violetta, what else is happening in the traffic?
This November 6th, you have the power to influence the course of politics. Follow the most comprehensive local political news online, chicagotribune.com/midterms.
And we are covering the verdict in the case of Jason Van Dyke, found guilty of second-degree murder and 16 counts of aggravated battery with a firearm, which carries actually the more significant load in terms of sentencing. There are protests in downtown Chicago that seem to be celebratory. There's one on Michigan Avenue that we are covering here. I want to check in very quickly with Tom Skilling, brought to us by Permaseal Basement Systems, in the Weather Center at WGN. There's rain moving in, isn't there?
There is, Ro. We've got a couple of scattered showers the next couple of hours, but it looks like between 8 and 9:30, the first of what will be a series of heavy rains are coming into the area with thunder and lightning. And we've got a flash flood watch that kicks in at 7 o'clock, runs through tomorrow afternoon. This is going to be a wet weekend. It'll come in waves, but even by morning, some areas may have received 1 to 3 inches of rain. So it's going to rain heavily tonight. It looks like the most concentrated rains will be I-80 and north. Not that it won't rain south of that, but that's where the heaviest rains will be.
And so what time should it be hitting downtown?
So we're talking about probably 7, make that 8:30 and 9 o'clock.
Tonight.
Yeah.
And there could be a shower tonight.
Before that. What's that?
And then raining throughout the night?
Yes, off and on. Yes, okay. With some pretty heavy downpours.
All right. All right. Tom, thank you very much.
You bet, Ro. See you.
Tom Scaling, the WGN-TV Newsroom and Weather Center. All right. Let's talk to Lori Lightfoot. She also would like to be the mayor of the city of Chicago. And we've only talked about 15 or 16 other potential candidates for mayor today since this whole thing started. But Lori, you have a particular perspective on this, because you were part of that with the Police Accountability Board, right? That was
right.
that had responsibility for looking into things like this. First of all, your initial reaction to the guilty verdict of second degree murder.
Well, as you know, it's very unusual for a jury to find an officer guilty of on-duty conduct. So this jury obviously put aside a lot of distractions and really focused on the evidence, and I think brought back a verdict that was consistent with the evidence. So we have to thank them for performing their civic duty under trying circumstances. And so far, from what I've been seeing, the protest and response to the verdict have been very peaceful, and that's always a good thing as well.
Lori, how do you respond when you hear the police officer statements? I'm sure you've seen some of them. The FOP, Dan Herbert, and other officers have come forward to say that this is going to, what officer will want to be proactive in this environment when you're dealing with a man with a knife who is disobeying police officers? They may just stand down, and they're making those kinds of inferences that this may affect policing in some way. How do you respond to that?
Well, I hope it actually affects policing in a positive way. If you look at that videotape and you see all those other officers who were out there on the scene for some time before Jason Van Dyke and his partner got there, they were giving Laquan McDonald time and distance, which is what they're trained to do, and none of them had their guns pulled. Not a single one of those other officers believed that Laquan McDonald could pose any kind of a lethal threat.
Oh, wait. Let's hold on. The officer that was trailing, who had been in the police SUV that had gotten its tire popped out, that police officer has a gun drawn, according to the testimony, behind him.
Well, I wish you certainly don't see that on the video.
Right, because he's behind the camera.
There were probably 10 officers that were out there that were watching this thing unfold over probably 20 minutes time, however long it was, and they didn't believe that this guy posed a lethal threat. And even if there's an officer out there whose gun was drawn, that's news to me. But going with what you said, none of them pointed their gun and pulled the trigger. Jason Van Dyke is the last guy in with his partner. I heard new testimony yesterday that I hadn't heard before, that on the audio tape that was recorded as he was heading there, saying something to the effect of, "We got to shoot him." I don't believe that under the unique circumstances here, and frankly, that shooting took place 4 years ago, that suddenly now officers are not going to do the right thing if they need to protect themselves or protect other people. The notion that if we hold officers accountable for intentional misconduct, that is going to have a chilling effect on officers, I think, frankly, does a disrespect to the profession of policing. Officers are trained to respond to the facts and circumstances in front of them. This jury believed that Officer Van Dyke's killing of Laquan McDonald just wasn't justified on the facts and circumstances that were there. So I think other officers, every single day since October of 14, have been doing their job in a lot of different circumstances. And I just don't believe that we can extrapolate from today's verdict that suddenly every officer is going to feel like they're under a different and inappropriate microscope.
Right.
Of course, there's a heightened awareness about policing today And obviously, all the facts and circumstances, not only of Laquan McDonald's killing, but also the way in which the aftermath of that shooting was handled, both at the police department level and in the mayor's office, are something that we're all conscious of. It has raised a consciousness and awareness, I think, of people across every demographic and every neighborhood in the city.
All right. Lori, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much. Appreciate your time, Lori Lightfoot.
Thank you.
All right. Check in here. We've got Pat Brady is going to give us some legal and political analysis of what this means, not only just in here for the law, because you're a former Cook County State's Attorney, but it also what this means for the mayor's race potentially. We'll get all of that. But first, Judy Pilak standing by. She's got the WGN News in two.
This season.
Bro Concho with Anna DeVlantis right here at 720 WGN. All right. Just for people who are following the play here, we have our own Ryan Burrow, who's with the protesters out on the street right now on Michigan Avenue. And Eric Rung is going to be out there. Doma Tipongo, who was out with the protesters, is back in the studio with us. We're going to talk to him in just a moment about what's happening. We also have the great Pat Brady is with us to talk about not only the legal impact of this, because you're a former federal prosecutor and a former Cook County State's Attorney. You also you got a little thought about the grand scheme of politics here, especially as it pertains to the mayor's race that is coming up. Anita Alvarez, though, joins us first, right now on the phone, and Anita Alvarez, of course, was the former Cook County State's Attorney, and at the time at which you did actually file these charges, but there was a lot of controversy that surrounded these charges being filed.
Absolutely, and I think we all lived it, Ro, and you know it. Obviously, when I charged the case, I felt very strongly that it was justified, that the charges were justified, and seeing the verdict today, I am pleased. I believe justice has been done on this case. I was just watching State's Attorney Joe McMahon do his press conference, and he pointed out, you know, as I said from day one, that we started the investigation concurrent, you know, doing this jointly with the feds, with the U.S. Attorney and the FBI, Department of Justice, you know, weeks after we received the video. So there was a lot that was done on this case. I felt strongly when I brought the charges, and till this day I do, and I have been watching, and I am pleased with the verdict on second degree, because I think it's clear that the jury did not believe that he was justified in his use of force.
You brought a murder first degree, and the jury instructions were they could consider the second degree, which is what they ultimately convicted him of. Did you see that at the time, that might be a possibility, or what do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, first degree murder, and, you know, many people don't understand our statute here in Illinois, because our laws are different than other states, and first degree murder, in order to get to second degree, the prosecution has to prove every element of first degree, and then obviously there has to be mitigating factors that would take that down from first degree and bring it, mitigate it down to a second. So was that a possibility that I saw back when we charged? Well, absolutely, because we're dealing with an on-duty police officer. I mean, back then, I knew what his defense was going to be. His defense was going to be that he was justified in the use of force. Clearly, if you read the statute and you see the language of second degree, it says unreasonable belief in self-defense. So back then, when we charged, absolutely, we knew that that was a possibility.
Well, is part of this verdict the fact that there is actually there was apparently, it appears that there was a cover-up that's being charged, actually. There's some officers who are, you know, going to go to trial in the next couple of weeks on, you know, whether or not there was a cover-up surrounding the paperwork on this case. And there were some shifting stories. I mean, is this really more an indictment of that type of police, you know, blue line or cover-up or whatever you want to call it, as opposed to the actions of this one police officer?
Well, Well, I think, you know, we'll have to wait and see what happens with those charges when those officers do, in fact, go to trial. But I think, no, that I think this case is really about officers and the use of force and what is justified, what is not justified. I mean, I know what the law is. I know how they're trained. And I know, you know, we all know that there are obviously more hardworking, honest, good police officers every day who put their life on the line for us. But we also know that there's a fine line. What you can argue is, hey, this is justified because this is what I was trained and what is not. And I was listening to some of the comments by some of the jurors, and the one man kept saying, we felt he should have done something more to de-escalate. And I think that's a good point, because the evidence that came out in court, those first two officers on the scene, what did they say? They called for a taser car. They weren't shooting. They didn't pull out their guns, and they didn't immediately shoot. You know, I felt strongly then, and I still do now, that every officer should have a taser on them. And, you know, there are situations where there can be a de-escalation, and there should be, and officers should be better trained in being able to do that so something doesn't end up in a shooting when it doesn't have to be.
And do you think it's strange they found him not guilty on the official misconduct, even though the much greater charges they did find the guilty verdict?
I thought it was a little strange. However, the official misconduct is the lowest class felony in there. So it's something that I think their justification was, well, he was an officer. He could carry a gun. He can use force. So he really, you know, he was just unreasonable in his use of force. So I don't know. It was a little strange. But overall, though, as the prosecutor, you're not that concerned about an official misconduct charge.
All right. Anita, thank you very much. Appreciate your time. Anita Alvarez.
Thank you.
Former Cook County State's Attorney. All right. Speaking of former Cook County Assistant State's Attorneys, Pat Brady is with us. You just heard what Anita Alvarez said. Do you agree?
I do. I do agree. I said all along it was a second. If you read the second degree murder jury instructions, he reasonably believed he had to use deadly force, but that belief was unreasonable objectively. And I think this is a perfect second-degree murder case.
Were you surprised by the jurors, how strong they were, and that they felt they did not believe Jason Van Dyke? They were, more than one of them spoke about how he shouldn't have even gotten up there because he didn't help himself. He wasn't credible. He was just trying to cover for himself. They didn't believe him.
I think the old rule of thumb back in the day was when the defendant hits the stand, that means they're going to lose. It never works right.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, it's all or nothing.
Right.
Unless the defendant becomes completely, Mike Monaco was just telling us about this, that unless the defendant is completely believable and wins over the jury, they lose. It's a big risk, and there's a very low probability of that happening.
Right, and it's up to him, too. That's his choice.
Yeah, Pat, Doma T. Pongo here. You, at the tail end of that conversation, Anita Alvarez talked about that official misconduct charge. When I was out doing some MOS interviews, I was talking to people, they were asking if, since he was found not guilty of official misconduct, does that mean he can still get his benefits and pension?
I don't know, but I would think convicted of a felony, no. Yeah, but the official misconduct is kind of a throwaway charge. I'm kind of surprised they kept... Remember we talked when they threw charges out right before the trial started? Ro and I, we spoke. Mm-hmm. I'm surprised they even kept it in. But I don't... I think it's more the conviction...
That has nothing to do with it.
I think it's more of a conviction of a felony. Official misconduct is, like she said, is just the lowest... I'm kind of surprised it was even in there.
Gotcha.
The thing that was interesting, though...
By the way, the official misconduct, the jurors were very clear about, the jurors who spoke about this were very clear about why they didn't find him guilty of that, and that is because he was a police officer, mm-hmm. and he had the right to carry his gun, he had the right to draw his gun, he even had the right to fire his gun, so all of those would have been the parameters, would have been the prerequisites for there to be a charge of official misconduct if he didn't have the right to do any of those things. It was a very strange charge to have in there in the first place, but I think that safety valve charge for the prosecutors who were thinking if they don't get the murder and they don't get the aggravated battery, maybe at least they'll get, you know, something. So as to quell public dissent here. And I think that's an important point. You know, there was a juror here who spoke who today said they were thinking about what the reaction in the street was going to be. Is that an item that his attorneys, that Jason Van Dyke's attorneys, can use in an appeal?
Could be. There might be an argument. I think you can have logically inconsistent verdicts, like a conviction on the other counts and not the official misconduct. I'm not sure if that's a reversible thing, though, on the what the juror might have said about what they're considering. They're only supposed to consider the facts before them, so that might be an issue.
Right.
If he'd shot once or twice instead of 16 times, would it all have been different?
I think so. But I think more so than that, which is what you guys touched on in the interview of Anita Alvarez, is the conduct that happened from the time this happened until he was actually charged. The slow roll, the cover-up, the hiding the video.
Paying off the family.
Paying off the family.
Secretly.
When they remember that night they rolled the video out? It was a Friday night right before Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
We were on the air.
Full moon. That was a scary night for a lot of people. I know the governor's office, they were on guard. So I think it was more the way it rolled out. Had they just been above board from the get-go with this, I think it would have been a lot less impactful.
I think that's my point with Anita Alvarez, which is that really, had there not been all the crazy things that happened around this and the attempt to cover it up, and then let's just sweep this under the rug, because it was a police-involved shooting, and there was video of it, and that was the problem. And then we learned also about the fact that the audio doesn't work in the cars, and there were, you know, a bunch of other kind of issues that were going on. All right, let's check back in. Speaking of protests, we've got Ryan Burrow out on Michigan Avenue with the protesters right now. And Ryan, the protesters have made the turn at Wacker and Michigan, and they are now facing the Trump Tower, and things seem to be breaking up.
I don't know if they're quite breaking up. They're not advancing, and there is no police barricade. So I have seen some people with signs kind of peel off and start heading back. We've been at this for about 2 hours now. We are on Wacker, directly across from the Trump Tower, and not nearly as many chants, a couple chants here at the end, but don't exactly know what the plan is at this point. They're kind of turning around, and I don't know what that means. You know, we have a tendency to see in these situations there be some kind of organization, and then when the organizations kind of peel off and start dropping off, then you just never quite know where the protest is going to go at that point. So that's kind of where we're at right now. If anyone's going to take charge, we just don't know.
All right. And at this point, there have been no arrests. There have it's been, like you said, a peaceful demonstration. Michigan Avenue had been blocked, at least the northbound lanes of Michigan Avenue, although I saw the protesters cross over into the southbound lanes of Michigan Avenue. From your vantage point now, is traffic, automobile traffic, moving on Michigan Avenue?
It is. Yeah, it is. And we saw just a handful of demonstrators kind of roll into those southbound lanes. You know, traffic was pretty much stopped. It was interesting because there were a lot of people in those southbound cars that basically couldn't go anywhere, and they were honking and actually cheering on some of the demonstrators, and that kind of emboldened them even more to cheer and chant. So, you know, kind of an interesting moment there. But, yeah, nothing going on right now on Michigan Avenue. Traffic seems to be flowing fine. Everything is isolated in this block directly in front of Trump Tower on Upper Wacker.
We had several listeners wonder, what are they protesting? Is it more of a celebration of a verdict that they are happy with or pleased that there is justice here? Or are there additional reasons or concerns that they're voicing in terms of something to protest?
It is a bit of a celebration. You can hear that in some of the chants they've had, but they continue to put pressure on the police department. You might be able to hear some of the chants they've got going on right now, and they say that this is just the beginning. There are more wrongs that they think need to be righted, especially in the African American community and with this city government, with the mayor and with the aldermen as well. They plan to be very active as we head into this political season, not only at the national level, but the mayoral race, which you guys have covered. And I have a feeling that we're probably going to see more and more of these demonstrations, even with the verdict being what it was, popping up in the coming weeks.
All right. We'll come right back out to you if things change out there. Ryan Burrow, who is with the protesters at Michigan Avenue and Wacker. Violetta, what other traffic is being impacted by this?
Chicago Marathon takes place this weekend, and Steve Cochran, well, he was on the fence about whether or not he was going to run it. Tune into the show 6 in the morning on Monday and see if he did it.
Okay, we'll find out.
I think it's time.
Actually, we talked about that earlier this week about both of us getting into it, and I was thinking about, you know, he and I could ride in a golf cart, but I don't think a golf cart can go 26.2 miles without running out of juice.
I don't think you get a medal for that either.
All right. Violetta's got an update on the traffic in the traffic center right now. It does appear that this protest is moving across Michigan Avenue Bridge.
Yes, they're back on the move northbound on Michigan Avenue. It seems that they're staying in the northbound lane. So again, seeing rolling closures and problems on Michigan Avenue. You want to steer clear of that. We originally thought they were going to stay westbound on Wacker, but now they are headed northbound, just crossing the river and Michigan Avenue North.
All right. Let's check in actually with our own Ryan Burrow, who's with them. Ryan, can you hear me?
Hey, I can't hear you. You guys might be able to see a better view now of how many people we're talking about, because I can see your window up there. You might be able to see where
we see it, probably a couple hundred people.
Yeah,
the Michigan Avenue Bridge.
It's, several hundred.
Yeah, it is, and you're now heading north on Michigan Avenue. This is something that Chicago police were hoping to avoid.
Yeah, you know, that being said, they have handled this very similar style protest. We've seen this on Black Fridays when they have these blackout demonstrations, essentially, which came out of the Laquan McDonald shooting over the day, you know, Black Friday, the day after Thanksgiving. And we're kind of making that same path right now. You know, it's one thing that Father Michael Flager said, if there was not a conviction, he was recommending a shutdown of the city economically, telling people not to shop there, not to go to school and whatnot. I don't necessarily know that that's the intention here, but one of the things that we've seen in previous years is that these demonstrations have attempted to shut down some of the businesses up and down the Mag Mile. So we'll see how this is handled. Police, really, the presence isn't nearly as strong as we've seen previously. We had seen, you know, bike police kind of flanking both sides. Now the sidewalk is essentially wide open to everyone. As we get up closer to some of these buildings, there are some police in front of them, but really, that's about it, Ro.
Ryan, it also seems like it's a pretty diverse crowd out there. Could you describe it for us in terms of what you're seeing in the crowd of protesters?
Yeah. You know, you've got a lot of college-age students, a lot of young people, and, you know, African-Americans, white, Hispanic. We've seen some Asian-American groups in there, some Middle Eastern groups as well. A lot of different organizations that have kind of joined this fight over the years, dating back to 2015. We've seen a lot of these speakers before. We've seen a lot of these leaders. Talked with Frank Chapman, who called this a victory, but it doesn't sound like this is the end. I mean, they've been fighting for this for 3 years. They seem fairly pleased with what they got. But on the other hand, too, they just see it as turning the chapter and getting into maybe some of these other situations, these other cases involving African-Americans and police involvement. And obviously the demands call continue for Rahm Emanuel to step down. He's leaving, but they want him to step down immediately. And they're probably going to push pretty hard in these final months of the mayor's term.
All right. Stay with them, and we'll check back with you. Ryan Burrow, who's with the protesters who are now heading north on Michigan Avenue from the Chicago River. There's a couple hundred of them out there. And as you heard, they are on the northbound lanes. Southbound lanes, there's still some traffic moving on the southbound lanes, and police on either side of these protesters as they're moving in. It has remained peaceful thus far. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it, Ryan. We've got Judy Pollack standing by for the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom at WGN Radio in 2 minutes. Ro Concho with Anna DeVlantis right here on 720 WGN. All right, protesters on Michigan Avenue right now. Violetta's got all the details on that. They are at Ontario, blocking the intersection of Michigan and Ontario. Of course, Ontario is the feeder for
a lot of people.
For everything, basically, mm-hmm. for the Kennedy and the Ryan and all that. So we'll see what happens there. All right. Right now, and again, if you're just joining us, the news today is that Jason Van Dyke, the Chicago police officer that was charged with murder in the shooting of Laquan McDonald, was found guilty by a jury today of second-degree murder and 16 counts of aggravated battery with a firearm. Interestingly enough, official misconduct, they found him not guilty on. Mm-hmm. And some of the jurors have spoken to the media, and now we're going to be joined by a juror. Juror number 248 is joining us. And thank you very much for your service, first of all, in doing this. And let's talk a little bit about what that experience was like for you. When you came in, can I just start at the beginning with you, if I can, about the, once you realized that you could be impaneled on this particular jury, what that was like?
I realized as soon as I was an alternate that called in, and I realized looking at the calendar that it was very likely that we were being called in for that, and was a little taken aback.
Yeah.
I looked at it as there's like 5.3 million people in Cook County, and how did I get this jury summons, and then, you know, you're one of 200 that are brought through this process, and then you're one of 15 that ended up.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's interesting because that is what some of the other jurors who spoke said, which was they were there was one juror, I'm sure you're familiar with who he was. It was a man who was like he would take the public transportation every day, I think the train, he said, mm-hmm. and he would look at all these people and think to himself, how'd I end up on this jury? And how did that happen to me?
Another juror said when she was on public transportation, she noticed anytime anyone was reading something in a newspaper about the trial, she would get up and go to another car so she wouldn't be exposed to it. I mean, people, you took it very seriously, and
I know.
Thank you.
And actually, listening to your show is the first time I've listened to any news or anything since we were impaneled, because we took it very seriously that we were not supposed to listen to anything about the case, discuss the case.
Right.
And we had to avow every morning that we were doing that. So I know I took it seriously, and I know everybody else on the jury.
We really got the sense that it became between first degree and second degree, that acquittal was not an option for this jury. Was that a correct perception that we have?
Yes. I was saying we started out, we took a blindfold to get a baseline of where the jurors were at, and the result of that were 7 guilty, 2 not guilty, and 3 undecided. And so we started from there as a baseline, and then we started going through the evidence. We went through the notes we took. We reviewed the video, some of the evidence that was provided to us, and we moved towards that.
What do you think was the most compelling piece of evidence that you all agreed on that swung you toward the second-degree murder conviction?
Degree, or just because we had to first decide on first degree and then go to the mitigating factor.
Okay. Yeah, well, so however that came out, what was the one piece that really stuck out that everybody could agree on?
Well, we agreed that the video was, we were reviewing the video, and it came to kind of stepping forward instead of kind of retreating, or what you could have done to avoid the whole situation. You know, if you had just waited a little more time, it was those discussions, and which made it unreasonable that, you know, why didn't you wait for the taser? But what brought us down to mitigating was that we believed that he believed at the time that it was justified. So we took that as the mitigating factor, that at the time he fired that first shot, in his mind, he believed. So we looked at that from the perspective of Mr. Van Dyke.
When the idea of him stepping forward as opposed to stepping back, it seemed to me, just watching this, you know, on television as opposed to being in the room, the sense that I got was that there was a moment there where even he had to explain, when he was on the stand, when Jason Van Dyke was on the stand in his own defense, he was trying to explain that he thought he was moving back, but you know, the prosecutor's like, no, but you were moving forward, weren't you? You were moving forward. And was that a moment that stuck out for you as well, that as a juror, that he couldn't possibly have had both thoughts in his mind?
We just approached it as, you know, he perceived at the time that what he was doing was justified, but in the end, it was not justified. So that's where we got to the mitigating factor. And when we were talking about it, you know, we watched that video a few times, and someone had pointed out stepping forward and you know, should have de-escalated it, and, you know, de-escalated mm-hmm. or waited, and that was part of the discussion. But we did go to what was he thinking at the time, and whether, you know, he thought he was backpedaling or, you know, and he was actually moving forward. We just looked at it from what was his perspective, what was going through his mind.
So the
And we looked at, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So the aggravated battery part, which is interesting, because the aggravated battery actually carries a longer sentence than does each count, carries longer sentence than does the one count of murder in the second degree. Was that something that, how did you guys come to the decision about the aggravated battery?
Well,
Well, first of all, we didn't have any idea what any sentence these counts carried.
Mm-hmm.
And so they looked at it as, at first, there was some discussion of maybe the first or second that he thought it was justified, and but the rest were excessive. But then we went to, you know, once the first shot was not justified, you know, the other 15 were not off.
And how great a role did the 16 shots play on this jury, the fact that it wasn't one or two shots, that there were 16, did that play any role in your decision to render this verdict?
We were looking at it as, I think we looked at it as once the first shot was fired, then all the shots afterwards. Because otherwise we would have probably not found him guilty on one of the two counts. We had also trouble, you know, which was the actual first shot. There was some discussion of the shot that hit the pulmonary artery. Was that, the one shot? But it went to once the first shot was taken.
Yeah.
It just can't get it. But the reason why I called was because I really didn't want to talk about it after this. I'm driving home. But because I heard you talking to Pat Brady and saying that one of the jurors said that they were aware of what was going on outside and that factored into our decision. And that did not factor in at all. I don't know who said it, because we had three that were on video and the rest of us were over to the side. So I'm not really sure who said it, but I can assure you that that was never, ever taken into consideration. We were only looking at the counts, our jury instructions, and the evidence, and anything going on outside was not a factor at all. You know, someone brought up that race wasn't at all. It was just this case. It was this case and only this case.
Right.
And we were only going to look at the evidence that was presented, and anything you might know outside of the case would not be considered. It was only what we were given.
In the deliberations, you're saying there was never a conversation about any of these other things except for the evidence that was in the case.
Right, right. There was never, ever, ever a conversation about what was going on outside.
I would like to get your comment on this, though, because the African-American woman who was a juror, I can't remember her number exactly at this moment, but she did sit with the two other jurors for the cameras, and she was asked if she thought that race played a role here, and she said she didn't until the moment that Herbert had mentioned the word Boy Scout, that had Van Dyke shot a Boy Scout with a knife, it would be different because Laquan McDonald was not a Boy Scout. Did that moment stick out to you in any way?
Well, I know she just thought it was an inappropriate comment that to use the contrast of Laquan McDonald and a Boy Scout, that was just an inappropriate comparison. But I don't know that that would have been something that jumped out. We just had mentioned that that was an inappropriate comment to make.
What about the comments Jason Van Dyke, Officer Van Dyke, made to his partner, Walsh, about we're going to have to stop this guy, we're going to have to maybe shoot this guy? Those comments, did they play a role? Did they come up in your deliberations?
Yes, they did.
Was that a major factor, would you say?
Yes, I would say.
Interesting. And if I might just... again, thank you for your service.
Absolutely.
Here. And when I heard you guys were going to be sequestered, I kept thinking to myself, oh my gosh, what is that going to be like? You know, because that's a tough thing, right? I mean,
it's
you know, that's it. Was it a difficult night last night, or did everybody get along?
Oh, we actually all got along throughout the entire proceedings. You know, everybody, we actually would try, you know, despite the gravity and the importance of, you know, what we were doing, the task that was at hand, we tried to stay light at the appropriate times and kind of put it out of our heads. You know, we were together a lot, and, you know, you just try to, we enjoyed each other's company. We all, you know, talked about families and, you know, and we knew our first names. We knew a lot of it. And I think I speak for all of us that we genuinely enjoyed each other.
And so that part wasn't, we didn't have the part about throwing things at each other. And everybody was just very respectful, you know. And so, as I said, our first blind, you know, ballot, you know, we got that. And then people, everybody had an opportunity to talk through it. And, you know, and that was a process. And, you know, if someone had concerns, then other people, there was a lot of give and take that was involved in getting us to that unanimous verdict.
All right. Well, Juror 248, thank you very much again for your service to Chicago, your service to Cook County, and thank you for calling us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Let's check in with Judy and find out what else is going on at the bottom of the hour here, the latest. If we could, or should we check in with Violetta first? It's a sort of, let's go with Violetta first. What's happening on the roadways?
November 6th, you have the power to influence the course of politics. Follow the most comprehensive local political news online, chicagotribune.com/midterms.
All right, we will talk to a couple of other people who want to be mayor who want to comment on this. Gary Chico and Paul Vallis are scheduled to join us here in this upcoming hour. We'll put that juror up for podcast coming up in just a few minutes here, as soon as we can turn that around. We just talked to one of the jurors, Juror 248, who explained what the whole process was like and what really were the determining factors for them today. And fascinating. And we were just Pat Brady, who's still here, even though she called him out, and Anna and I were just discussing here how great it is to hear the wheels at work working properly, and to have a juror like that, and the other jurors who stood up here and said, you know, they went in, they heard this trial, they got along, they did what they were supposed to do, they gritted their teeth, and they had tough choices to make, but they stayed with the evidence and they did what they were supposed to do. And that should make us all feel better about the system.
It does. It's heartening, isn't it? They said they listened to each other, respect each other. They worked through things. They talked through things to reach a consensus. It just gives you so much faith in the system.
And not a complaint.
No, and nobody being ridiculous or anything. They really talked through very difficult decisions and
they
took
listened
this
to
seriously.
The jury instructions. They did what they were supposed to do, and I think the jury verdict that they came up with met the facts, so they did a great job.
Can they go to Washington and train some of the people in Congress how to act? You know?
Maybe they should give everybody in Congress numbers.
Yeah.
Instead of names.
Yeah, just
I just want to know
and act like this jury.
Hand towels in the hotel that they put them up in last
You're worried
night.
About
that was
that.
My greatest concern.
Were they on Cicero or I mean, were they?
No, I don't know. I always like to think about that sportsman. I don't think it's still there. The motel on Cicero on your way to Midway.
You have to rent it by the half hour.
You drive by that place and you're like, who stays here? Really, I just want to know who stays here. And if it's a jury, you're like, we're not treating our jurors right. All right, let us now check in with Judy. She's got the WGN news. Concho with Anna DeVlantis right here, 720 WGN. Let me just check in with Ryan Burrow very quickly. We also have Pat Brady in the studio with us, who just makes jurors mad. That's why, as a former federal prosecutor and state attorney, he's no longer doing those things. He's just made jurors mad. All right, we'll explain that.
I did have one once tell me, we voted guilty, but you didn't do a very good job.
Oh.
There you go. That explains everything. All right, Ryan Burrow has been out with the protesters today in the aftermath of the guilty verdict in the Jason Van Dyke trial, guilty of second-degree murder and 16 counts of aggravated battery. And this protest had wound its way from City Hall down to Michigan Avenue, down Michigan, over the period of about 3 hours here, a little bit more than 3 hours, that they wound their way to Michigan and Ontario, breaking up now.
Yeah, it is. They basically formed a huge chain circle at the intersection of Michigan and Ontario. They said their pieces. You know, they thanked everyone who'd been coming out. You've got to understand, a lot of these people have been together marching and rallying for the last 4 years since Laquan McDonald was fatally shot. So it was bittersweet for a lot of people. And I talked to some people who actually had the visitor tag on from the courtroom itself. They were down there, saw the verdict come down, and then immediately came out here and joined some of their friends and people who supported them and supported the mission. And they said that it's not really a celebration, but a little bit of relief, actually. They didn't know what to expect when they went into the courthouse, and now they're out here essentially with their friends, and there are smiles, and they can turn the page and kind of move on from here.
All right. So, well, we'll keep you out there till the last protester gets back on the sidewalk.
It may be me. I may be protesting the Rokon show.
Yeah, you know what? You should protest, you know, Pat Brady, because everybody else seems to be doing that.
Hey,
here
I'm going to go flip my own car over and protest to the Rokon show.
See, that's what you should do. And I would join you in that. So would our producers. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Well, is Carnarvon wagon rolling? Let me just put it to you
this way. There might be some sipping on the Carnarvon wagon without the Carnarvon wagon officially being rolled out by a restaurant here. But it's a Friday afternoon after 5 o'clock. The Carnarvon wagon is rolling. All right.
Now, the protesters here said that there is a kickback party later tonight. So that's an option, too.
Oh, my. All right. Well, we'll find out more about that. There's an after party for the trial. Only in Chicago, would you have that? All right, thank you very much. We'll check back in with you as long as there is news out there. Gary Chico's joining us. He wants to be mayor of Chicago. And your reaction, sir, to the verdict?
Well, look, I was horrified when I saw that video, and I think it really showed the raw emotions in Chicago that exist in a lot of our communities. And, you know, look, I think you hit it on the head when you said earlier there's a sense of relief in the city. I think that the jury did a very, very difficult task today, rendered their decision, and now we have justice for Laquan McDonald. And, you know, now we can get about the issue of healing the city. We have a lot of work to do in front of us. The trust level between police and communities is really, really low, and we have to work to rebuild that. And I'd like to say one other thing, too, Ro. We have to remember that the actions of Officer Van Dyke don't represent the Chicago Police Department. In fact, at that very scene, there were 7 other officers, none of whom fired a shot. So I think people have to remember that when they're trying to work with the Chicago Police Department. There's a lot of good men and women that go to work every day to protect us and do the right thing by our communities.
Let me ask you this, though. From the perspective of police officers who are working the job now, we talk to them quite a bit, on and off the air, people who have either done this job or are currently doing this job. And you wonder if you are an officer and you're confronted with somebody with a knife and they are coming at you and they're closing the distance and all of the arguments that the defense made here about why he fired his weapon. Let's take out the 16 shots for a moment and what is maybe found to be a cover up here, because there's 3 other police officers who are facing trial for conspiracy here concerning how the paperwork was filed and the stories that were told. What do we say to the hardworking men and women who are out there right now? Thousands of them are on the street right now and tonight, bracing for having nothing to do with Laquan McDonald or having nothing to do with Jason Van Dyke, but just gang violence and all the rest of the stuff that goes on. How do you deal with somebody that is armed and feel that you're not going to go to jail?
Well, let's look at it this way. As we're speaking right now, these situations are occurring, and the vast, vast majority of police officers on the beat right now do the right thing. The vast majority of police officers that were on the scene during the night of the shooting of Laquan McDonald did the right thing. It's called judgment. And I think that you're finding that throughout the entire city, day to day to day. It's true that on occasion we see a situation that really alarms us, really shocks us. And those are the things we have to try to solve. So I think you see in individual officers good judgment, good restraint, and the best police officers I've ever seen try to talk situations down. Now, in those occasions, when officers are faced with lethal force on them, then they obviously have the right to defend themselves and subdue the situation. But I'm going to tell you that, by and large, my experience with police officers has been that they exercise good judgment.
you want to lead the city, Gary. What do you think about how do you heal us? How do you bring us forward from here when you think about this important moment in this city's history and make it a turning point?
I think there's several things you have to do, Anna. You have to, first of all, reinstitute community policing so that we start talking to one another again on a regular basis and establish dialogue and trust district by district, beat by beat. That has to happen. It went away 10, 11, 12 years ago, and it's only come back to a very spotty level. Also, we have to have the best trained police force in the United States. Let's go back to the situation with Laquan McDonald. 4 years ago, we didn't have tasers on the scene that might have been a non-lethal response to that situation. It took us 2 years after that to get what we think today is enough tasers, and then we're still playing a little bit of catch-up today with the police department being prepared to deal with people with mental health issues. So I think if we set a standard to have the best trained police force in the United States, we're not going to be in situations like this nearly as often, and we're going to be ahead of the curve. We need to get our research and development at a top level and try to prevent these tragedies from happening ever again in our city.
All right, Gary Chico. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Thanks,
sir.
Gary.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. Pat, you've worked on the law enforcement side of this, both in the local and federal government. You deal with a lot of police officers, FBI agents, people like that. And, you know, there is quietly, not always quietly, but in most cases quietly, a real concern about how you go about doing your job here. What do we say to police officers tonight?
That's why I was interested in the question that you asked Gary Chico, who's been on the cutting edge of a lot of reforms in this city, particularly in education. We're not just healing the community. How do we heal the police force to deal with that question? Because if you're a police officer and you don't think anybody has their back, I'm not getting out of the car.
And that's what you're hearing from the Fraternal Order of Police tonight. Yeah. You're saying, how does this give us the feeling that we should be proactive on a scene and that we should actually go after the person with the gun?
But let's go back to the fundamental problem. We have neighborhoods where people are getting shot like this, and the crime problem in general, I think, needs to be addressed in conjunction with policing.
Right.
I mean, why do we have these pockets of crime that you can't go into?
One of the things that is startling to, I think, to a lot of police officers, and I think to a lot of people who don't live in crime-plagued neighborhoods, is they see young men marching today, and young men and women marching today, about the people who are actually being shot. By one person being shot by a police officer, when there are dozens upon dozens upon dozens of people shot on a weekend in Chicago by people they know. So how is it, or know of, how is it possible that we are not completing that circle? That why isn't there enough outrage from these young men and women who took to the streets on Michigan Avenue today to protest a police shooting 4 years ago and the trial and the second-degree murder conviction of this police officer, to celebrate that, and not to celebrate the conviction of gangbangers who were getting, or anybody who's getting convicted of shooting anybody else in this town? I mean,
the video and
cops
the
get really nuts about that, I think rightfully so.
I don't blame him, but I think in this case it was the video and then the way everything rolled out that kind of led into the boy, what is going on here?
That's right.
The cover up. There's the 16. The video was unbelievable.
The narrative from the police department, the narrative from the city, the fact that the video was withheld, the payoff to the family. There was all those moves
and the
made.
Fact that it was racial.
Because it was a white police officer and a black.
Yeah, tensions
teenager.
Are running high throughout the city. I mean, that is what it boils down to.
But doesn't it all? So if it's intra-racial, it's not an issue? I mean, but you've had situations like that, there was a police shooting on the Northwest Side. Well, I'm turning where the kid was they said was running away, running into the park, and then a police officer shot him, and that was an intra-racial shooting. I mean, does it matter if it's blue, black, white? It's always blue, right? I mean, that's one of the issues.
Yeah, I think the flip side of that, not too long ago, Commander Bauer gets executed over at the Thompson Center.
Yeah.
And so to me, it's the underlying crime creep in this city and that we need to address, and I think some of these problems might go away. I've always been for much more aggressive, shut it down and stop it, and then go forward with a solution.
But how does one do that? I mean, I think
no one
really
likes my solution, but I'd call National Guard and shut it all down until it stops. I bet you'd be a hero, whatever politician would do that.
But does the National Guard have arrest powers?
I'm not sure if they do or not.
They don't.
I think a strong,
that's the problem with well, that.
Do you think the presence alone
yeah,
would
this,
be
let's
enough?
Just shut it down. Shut down the off-ramps. Just shut it down for a while and clean it out. And I bet you in those neighborhoods, the people that actually are trying to live and work and raise kids would be thrilled.
All right.
But no one's been that aggressive. That's why I'm not elected.
That's why he's not running for mayor. That's why even his own juries can't stand him. All right, stay right here. Don't anybody move. Let's find out what's happening on the roadways here, because it's still a Friday everywhere else in this town, and it's starting to rain.
So this weekend, it's the marathon Sunday, and Steve Cochran, well, he's on the fence about whether or not he'll run. Tune into the show at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to guess neither one of you will run it, but no. Yeah. We'll be
Steve and I
in.
Are doing a show Sunday from the United Center before the Blackhawks game.
You're going to be in pain.
Kind of thinking that maybe we need to save up the energy for that, but we'll figure it out. All right. The jury has spoken, and Jason Van Dyke has been found guilty of second-degree murder and 16 counts of aggravated battery in the shooting of Kwame McDonald. And Paul Vallis is joining us. He is running for mayor. And your initial response to the verdict, sir?
I'm not surprised. Obviously, I didn't hear all the evidence that was presented to the jury, but based on the things that I was following in the press, both his testimony and the testimony of other officers, I'm not surprised with the decision. Clearly, the verdict holds Van Dyke accountable for his actions. But, the verdict's also an indictment of the political leadership that really failed to be honest and transparent with the public from the beginning. That same leadership that failed to train and equip these officers. At the time, I think the police department had 600 tasers. New York had 15,000 tasers. And so, there was a real failure of leadership, the failure just to move quickly to hold people accountable after serious incidents like that. So I think, while the verdict holds Van Dyke accountable, I think there needs to be some political accountability, too.
What do you say to Chicago police officers who might feel otherwise tonight?
Well, look, it's... Clearly, you're going to have a lot of upset officers. I come from a family of four police officers. My two sons are police officers. But for those who are upset with the verdict, it's important to remember that the overwhelming vast majority of Chicago police officers are the highest caliber individuals, and they've chosen to serve because they love their communities. They love Chicago. I have four police officers in my family. My wife was a police officer. My father's only sibling was a 36-year veteran of Chicago police officers, 3 decades as a detective. My two boys are police officers in Wheeling and San Antonio. And police officers, I think the vast majority of the public realizes that police officers are of the highest caliber and that they risk their lives every day for our safety. So, the police officers need to be supportive, and they need the type of leadership that's going to give them the support, the resources, and the infrastructure to ensure that not only are they effective and protected, but also that there's the appropriate supervision and accountability.
You want to increase the number of police officers, particularly detectives. I've heard you talk about Paul, and do you think that police officers have the support they need? And in terms of building, how do you build something for them so that they feel as if they can be proactive and still, if they're doing the right thing, be protected? Because you heard from the FOP today, they're feeling, and maybe it's just a gut reaction and emotional, but they're saying, what cop would still want to be proactive in this environment?
Well, look, I think and I'm not trying to be political on this. Clearly, when you allow 2,000 police positions not to go vacant, and now they're only now beginning to fill them, when you allow your detectives division to literally be cut in half, and now, of course, they're rushing to fill those vacancies, but, of course, so many of the detectives that are being hired now simply don't have the experience yet. When you went from one sergeant for every 10 officers to one
Sergeant Tevi 30 officers, or for that matter, when you waited for years to provide, you know, even a small percentage of police officers with tasers and the taser trainings, you almost create conditions for these things to happen. Look, you know, Van Dyke is being held accountable for his actions, and he, and the jury has spoken. But at the end of the day, you know, by our actions, our failure to provide the police officers with the not only the resources they need, but the infrastructure, the sergeants, the training, the training officers, the ongoing redundant training that people in the military take for granted, where they're being trained in certain procedures and certain actions and standard operating procedures and such. I mean, we almost create conditions within which there will be conflict between the police officers and the community.
All right. We'll leave it there. Paul Vallis, thank you very much. Appreciate your time, sir. All right.
Thank you.
Let's check in with Judy here, the WGN News. Steve Cochran Show celebrates the most valuable person on the planet. Weekday mornings at 720 on 720 WGN Chicago. I'll get to Judy in just one moment, I'm being told, actually. I was going to go to Judy, but now, Judy, I'm not going directly
to
you.
You always stand me up.
Yes. So let me do this first. Do you mind? Is it okay?
It's fine.
All right. Judy, in 1 minute. Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis right here on 720 WGN. Pat Brady is with us. I want to, we're going to do the top five here, the top five at six. Mm-hmm. And then we've talked to almost everybody who's running for mayor today, their reaction to the Jason Van Dyke conviction. But Pat, as a former state's attorney and federal prosecutor, the case here was won and lost where?
Won and lost the video.
The video itself.
Video. I think the juror even said that they spent a lot of time looking at the juror or at the video.
Here, the defense attorney Dan Herbert tonight. You weren't worrying that you made the wrong choice about bench or jury trial or putting him on the stand or not, because the jurors did seem to react very strongly that he was not a credible witness, the officer.
I think that was a tipping point too. And but I think Judge Gahan probably would have gone with second. To me, that like we talked about before, the jury instruction was a perfect second degree murder case. He believed he had the lawfully justified in using deadly force, but it was an unreasonable belief. And that's a second-degree murder.
That's what they found.
All right. Well, let us...
But give a lot of credit to a lot of people for doing this well. From Joe McMahon, the prosecutor, mm-hmm. and to the juror that we heard from, this was the system worked after they were charged.
Right.
I want to jump in here for just a second. This is Kevin Ryan. He's a Chicago police commander, and he's downtown talking about police control here.
To life as a police officer downtown.
That just ended right before we went to it right there. There was Joe Donlan anchoring Channel 9. We'll let him do his job there. We'll do our job here. That's okay. How we're going to do that. All right. I wanted to see what was being said there. But the protest, as Violette has been reporting, has come to an end there on Michigan Avenue, right?
Correct. All lanes back open in both sides of Michigan Avenue at Ontario. That's ended probably 15 minutes or so.
Okay. All right. Let us get in a top five at 6 o'clock here, because this is all, if you're just joining us, just getting to your radio, just heading home, you're stuck on the expressway trying to figure out what happened in Chicago today. Well, this will explain it all.
It's the top five on the Rokan Show.
Five. Let's go.
Now, it's the top five at five on the Rokan Show with Anna DeVlantis. Sponsored by the Hip and Knee Center, where they help you feel new again.
Ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Get on with it.
All right.
Number five.
Jason Van Dyke found guilty in a Cook County courtroom today.
We, the jury, find the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, guilty of second-degree murder. We, the jury, find the defendant, Jason Van Dyke, guilty of aggravated battery with a firearm.
And then they went through that 16 times.
Yeah.
Found guilty with aggravated battery. Mm-hmm. And one of the interesting pieces of that is that aggravated battery actually carries one count of aggravated battery with a firearm, carries more punch in terms of sentencing than does the second-degree murder charge.
Exactly. And second-degree murder, I believe, is probationable.
Right.
So it was significant that they were convicted on that, because aggravated battery with a gun is a Class X.
And the second-degree murder is a sentence from 4 to 20 years, is probationable, and if you, it also, you serve 50% of the time on whatever the sentence is. You can with good behavior. In the aggravated battery with a firearm, it is 6 to 30 years. You must serve 85% of the time. That's a big difference. If you had to guess here, how many years do you think you would get?
Oh, man, that's why when he said, when he revoked his bond and they get a pre-sentence report, I would think 20.
You think 20 years?
Mm-hmm.
I think it'll be less than 10.
Sentencing is October 31st when the judge will decide.
Okay, this is where my video comes in as some key part of it. Imagine this case without a video and you had all these police officers testifying, all the inconsistent statements you're going to get. You're going to get a not guilty. But Judge Gahan has got a video of him shooting this young man 16 times.
Here
does he want to send a message?
Yeah. Joseph McMahon, he was the prosecutor in this case.
The end of this trial marks an opportunity for this city to come together. This investigation, this criminal prosecution of Jason Van Dyke, I believe reflects our shared values and has been the result of people simply doing the right thing. A Hispanic man and his son who came forward to tell the truth. Police officers who remembered that their duty is to serve and protect all of us.
Number four.
Daniel Herbert was the lead attorney in the defense of Jason Van Dyke, and he says he wasn't surprised by the verdict and vowed an appeal because he wanted to move the trial outside of Cook County because of pretrial publicity.
How do we feel about the verdict?
Well, you know, I just talked to Jason about this. In this climate and with this case, I told Jason Van Dyke, I said, you just went into a heavyweight boxing match against Mike Tyson, and you went in there with both your hands tied behind your back, and you're still standing. You're still standing.
What they're saying to him there, I think, Pat, is that he's not going to spend the rest of his life in prison.
Right.
Hopefully.
Something we haven't talked about yet is he mentioned also in that speech that there's going to be a lengthy appeal process here and that they have a lot of legal options. What would you imagine would happen there?
You know, I'm not sure what the actual issues on appeal. I imagine the venue is going to be the big one. They're probably the standard issues that they raise, including ineffective assistance. But the difference, though, is there's no bond pending appeal. He's sitting in the
locker. You have to have other lawyers do that. Because ineffective assistance, you can't charge yourself with ineffective assistance. That would seem not to make a ton of sense.
But it's frequently an argument made at the appellate level. They raise it.
Your lawyer was bad.
Your lawyer was bad. It's rarely won. But there are standard kind of issues that raise. But the change of venue might be the big one. But it seemed like, and I didn't watch all of it, but it seemed like a fairly clean trial. Not a lot of real close calls on, and I may be wrong on that, but I don't know what the big issue is.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Have you ever been accused of being ineffective?
At a lot of things.
Yeah, that's what I thought. That's what I thought.
Radio commentary.
That's why we're friends.
Right.
Me too.
We had a listener who thought you were ineffective, so ineffective she had to call in.
Yeah.
And we're happy she did.
All right, we'll get to your three, your two, and your one, but first, Violetta, what's going on the roadways?
Travel times are starting to recover. Inbound travel time still a bit heavy, though. The Kennedy is 55 minutes, O'Hare to downtown. Outbound trip is just 40 minutes. In on the Eisenhower ahead of the JT concert at the United Center.
That's Justin Timberlake, by the way. We were one of the other things Mr. Brady is ineffective of is understanding popular culture. Is that who you're referring to?
That is exactly. And
okay.
The people headed that way know exactly who I'm talking about.
Okay.
Justin Timberlake, previously from NSYNC.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Do you know who NSYNC is, Pat?
You have to know who NSYNC is. Bye-bye.
Yeah, that's when you plug your laptop into your
exactly.
Your iPhone,
computer.
And it's NSYNC, right?
Oh,
there you go. I'm assuming that that means something, that all the music stopped playing and the commercials stopped playing.
It's time to
talk. Are we back? Is this us?
Top 5
at 5? Am I still ready to go? All right. Okay. Thought maybe there was something that needed to be read there. But no, it's the top 5-5, and we continue with that up to
number 3.
The jurors in the Van Dyke case thought that Officer Van Dyke was guilty when they entered deliberations. Wait. Let me start over there. I want to read this right, because this is actually legally significant here. I gotta start totally over on that. I'm not exactly sure what we're trying to say there in number three.
One of the things I would say, just listening to the jurors about when that they said that he should not have taken the stand. I took notes on it. He felt that he shouldn't have done that, that he was not convincing, credible. He was not credible, and his testimony didn't line up with what they saw on the videotape, and his memory was not good.
So should Jason Van Dyke have taken the stand?
I felt he shouldn't have. He messed up.
How?
I didn't. His testimony was incredible to me. I felt like he was trying to remember stuff that he said that maybe wasn't true, and he wanted to make sure he didn't trip himself up. So I didn't really feel his testimony was credible.
And you heard that from a number of the jurors that were interviewed.
Right, including a woman who called us, juror 248. Who called us and said one of the things that this came down to, and you heard this from other jurors, was the motion of Jason Van Dyke stepping toward Laquan McDonald versus back, which was in the initial reports that he had stepped away.
We watched that video a few times, and someone had pointed out stepping forward and you know, should have de-escalated it and, you know, de-escalated or waited. And that was part of the discussion, but we did go to what was he thinking at the time and whether, you know, he thought he was backpedaling or, you know, and he was actually moving forward. We just looked at it from what was his perspective, what was going on.
All right. And we want to thank her and all the jurors who did this, because this, however you feel about the verdict, this is an almost impossible thing to go and do. And we asked her specifically when we were talking to her on the phone, you know, did you know you were going in to be the juror in this case? Right? I mean, that's daunting, isn't it? When you stop and you think about that.
They all felt it.
You know, we talked about it before. What great public servants. They did it perfectly.
Right.
And everything she said when you interviewed her was exactly what she was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they all did it together and walked out, and I think justice was served.
Okay. And that's available for podcasts at WGNradio.com. That's juror 248 right there. Really interesting conversation.
Number two.
All right. For the activists that took to the streets afterwards, Will Calloway, who's been on this program, is a community activist. And he was one of the guys that actually pressured authorities to release the video in the first place. And here was his reaction.
We see these police injustices happening. The buck stop here in Chicago. And we pray and we hope that this gives some inspiration and encouragement, not only to the city of Chicago, but all cities across America, to let them know that excessive force and unlawful and unjustified and unreasonable use of force by police officers will not be tolerated. And we will hold each police accountable.
Number one.
On the other side of that coin here is the head of the Fraternal Order of Police Lodge that represents the Chicago Police Department.
I have talked to dozens of my members today. They were all wishing Jason well, everyone I talked to. They all believed he should not be convicted, the ones I've talked to. And they hoped that the verdict would have gone a different way. We, as I said a few days ago, we believe that the people of the city of Chicago were going to remain calm no matter what the verdict was. And because we do believe in the rule of law.
All right. And so far, so good in terms of that. In terms of people remaining calm and
peaceful protests.
There was a protest that lasted a couple of hours. We covered it. It started with a couple hundred people, dwindled down to a few dozen people at the corner of Michigan Avenue in Ontario, a little bit more than that, maybe about 50 people at that corner, making a human circle around that, stopping the intersection of Michigan Avenue and Ontario, which is one of the busiest intersections in Chicago on a Friday afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
But then they receded to the street. They talked to the media, and everybody's going home in advance of a gigantic rainstorm that is heading in.
And who was out there when I cut across the loop on the way in here but a bunch of police officers, fine public servants, trying to keep things moving. So
exactly.
You've got to recognize
and
their contribution.
Protecting the protesters.
Right.
Right, that we're celebrating. Imagine how hard this is.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Celebrating the imprisonment of a police officer,
right.
And where many of these police officers look at this and thought, I might have done the same thing.
Could have been me. I'm sure some of them are thinking that.
Right. And there they are doing what they're supposed to be doing. So that was this Friday in the city of Chicago.
The top five at five.
Bro Concho with Anna DeBlantis right here, 720 WGN. Pat Brady is here.
He is.
Willie Wilson joins us. He wants to be mayor. And we've talked to everybody else who wanted to be mayor today. We might as well talk to Willie Wilson, who wants to be mayor as well. And let's get your reaction, sir. Your initial reaction when you heard about the conviction of Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke.
Well, originally I was nervous, like pretty much a lot of other people in Chicago was, to see what the verdict was going to be. Certainly, we don't like violent. You know, we strictly is nonviolent. I do believe that the jury did a good job. No one's how to win in a tough situation like this, but I think they made the right decision, right verdict. I'll be honest with you. I just, my whole thing, I just kind of question in terms of what was the difference between the, why didn't they make the, they had a second degree, but who knows what happened with the first degree. But we'll have to see how that turns out. But regardless of which way it turned out.
By the way, it can answer that for you and get your reaction to it. Because we actually spoke with a juror on this program, and then three other jurors talked about this after the trial as well. And that was that they thought that Jason Van Dyke thought he was doing the right thing, that he thought he had the authority to do it, which is what made it second degree. It wasn't like he knew he was doing the wrong thing and did the wrong thing. So that was the mitigating factor that made it a manslaughter as opposed to a murder.
Well, even if he thought that, I mean, if you shoot a person 16 times, you got to think after two or three times he's already dead, you know? So, to me, that still doesn't make sense. But nevertheless, I support what happened today in terms of the verdict. Happened about there's no violence, anything like that. It's a day that we all, whether you Caucasian, Latina, Black, or whatever you happen to be, is that this was the right decision. We should be proud of our city. And the people of inner city, I think that was the right decision. That's what I, when video shows something, you're looking at it with your eyes, you cannot go against that or make believe or anything like that. So I think good job.
Jurors did say that was very compelling evidence, the one we talked to and others we saw interviewed. Willie, but as mayor, you'd be mayor of everybody, right? So what would you tell police officers on a night like tonight? You've heard from the FOP. You've heard from several officers speaking, saying that they feel as if this is not telling them they can be proactive on the job when they're facing someone with a knife, and they look at this in a different way. And what would you say to them?
Well, first of all, I just think the Chicago is too segregated. I think it's too segregated in terms of the police department as well as the neighborhood itself. But particularly at this incident here, we're talking about the police department. We must begin to take and integrate the police department so we can better understand one another. And we must make sure we have citizen inclusion, that is, within it as well. And I'm still believing there should be a closer watch on the police department as related to four different police superintendent, that you're not spread too soon, that you can get to your people more better, and you can have different training program. You can talk to people about the situation, how there's a different in different neighborhood and different people from different background, and making sure that we do that. But the citizen board could look at that is independently speaking, and making sure that everything is being done the right way.
In terms of the way that activists today are asking for more, this is just the beginning, many have said, and they would like to see bigger changes. Obviously, you just articulated some of them. Is there one, if you were to become mayor of Chicago, is there one thing you would push for?
Well, I think you got it wrong. When I become mayor, when I'm gonna be male.
Okay. However you want to put it, sir, I still want an answer to the question. What would you do?
What would I do? Mm-hmm. When I become mayor of Chicago with the police department?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we would here again. We would make sure that we have a board that is independent, as opposed to me as mayor running it by myself. You got to get inclusion from this community as well as the police department. And we all had to all sit down and make this thing work together. And we got to make sure that one neighborhood is treated the same as all neighborhoods treated. You know, but right now you got minority community. Look, more minority got tickets that ride bicycles, you know, than any other community. These things shouldn't exist, you know, and because as long as you do things like that, there can always be an issue. You got to treat all communities like one Chicago. I would make sure we work hard, we'll get that done, we'll fix that.
All right. Willie Wilson, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate your
time.
Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
It's interesting because we talked to Lori Lightfoot earlier, who ran IPRA, right? Mm-hmm. Which was the police response, you know, whatever that. There's been so many of them
now. They've called it so many things on purpose because many times it hasn't worked out the way they've handled things. But she was in charge of the police review board that reviewed these sorts of issues, matters with police officers.
So I think that's kind of where Willie was going with that. I don't know if I want to put words in his mouth. I'm sorry. Yes, Pat Brady.
Why doesn't the... Maybe the answer is to have the Attorney General be more involved in this and remove it.
The Illinois State Attorney General?
Yeah. Maybe that's where it needs to be housed versus overseen.
But they do jump in. I mean, I know that in these cases, because you can bring a state charge. As a matter of fact, the Illinois State Police and police-involved shootings are on the scene now, right? I don't know that they were back when this happened, but I believe that they were, and that's that you get the Illinois State Police involved. Is it time for the federal government to be involved in these? Would it be better if the U.S. Attorney's Office were involved in it, FBI?
I think removed from the imprimatur of the city, maybe, and giving it to somebody that at least is perceived as more independent. You know, in these appointments, they're all people that are appointed from the city, and they're all doing, and I think they're all trying to do the right thing, but maybe housing it somewhere else and funding it, maybe you'll get a better result and have more, and part of the better result is more public confidence in the result.
It's interesting because we always, you know, in every movie you see, like when the FBI shows up and the local cops are like, all right, look who just showed up now, you know, mm-hmm. about the FBI, and that there's this, that there's an interagency rivalry, and the cops hate FBI and FBI hate cops and things like that. And I've been in many rooms with police officers and FBI at the same time. And I think a lot more is made of that than needs to be made of it. There are task forces where everybody is working together. You worked on this. You were on task forces, Pat Brady,
sure,
that did these things with both cops and FBI agents. I think maybe it does make some kind of sense, at least in a place like Chicago, where we're having these moments of, I'd like to see a little bit more federal law enforcement involved on all sides of this.
I think this... I've said this before, and no one agrees with me. I think the solution to the crime problem here is a federal problem, and you need to put federal resources in.
Right.
Just in the
federal
real
charging of the of drug laws, yeah, of violence laws, of use of certain types of weapons that are being used. Yeah. You know, I think, and if these guys knew, the bad guys knew in town that they weren't going to be spending time in state prisons, but they were going to federal prisons somewhere else in the country, away from their friends or their family. I think it changes things. I mean, the kingpins, those guys expect to go away. But, you know, like a 22 or 23-year-old who's now kind of a middle-level manager, if you will, in, you know, the drug trade or whatever it happens to be, and he's ordering murders and doing that sort of stuff, or he gets involved in something that you know, would generally be a state case, but if all of a sudden he knows he's going to be spending time in San Quentin, right, it would be different.
But listen to the discussion we just had with Paul Vallis on the cutting of resources.
Mm-hmm.
We're cash-strapped here right now for whatever reason. Why not bring in federal resources where there are federal dollars?
Yeah.
Because look at the cost to commerce and the problems it causes, and this what we've gone through here in the last 3 years with Laquan McDonald. There needs to be, I think, a bigger, broader... And I'm not one to... I'm a Republican. I don't like federal solutions, but I think in law enforcement, in this instance, it probably is smarter to have a federal solution.
All right. I have more questions about you as a Republican, what you like and you don't like. I'd like to, I have a whole list of things I'd like to know the answer to, because I think I used to find that a rather predictable thing, and I find it very unpredictable now. I don't even know what any of it means. Very quickly, Kavanaugh gets, as a Republican, yes. As a Republican who's worked on the federal level and you ran the Illinois Republican Party as well, you think Kavanaugh gets confirmed tomorrow?
Yeah, I think there was a cloture vote, which is a procedural vote that kind of tipped everybody's hands on where they're going to vote. I think it'll be 51-48, because one of the Democrats is not going to show because his daughter's getting married. So
A Republican.
Was that a no?
I think it's a Republican.
It's a Republican.
Yeah, and they would bring him back if he needed to. That is a really interesting situation.
Well,
if he has to bring it to 50, I think it's going to.
He's not coming back because Manchin
said yes.
The four that matter: Susan Collins, Manchin,
Flake,
and Murkowski's the no. So they got the vote.
Three out of the four, right?
Three out of the
four. So it goes 51-49.
And Susan Collins gave about an hour-long speech before the procedural vote today and laid it out pretty well on why she's voting for him. Particularly, she started, I thought was most interesting, she started out talking about his judicial philosophy, and it pointed out how some of the arguments that the other side was making really weren't true.
Does it help that he wrote an op-ed apologizing for being too emotional?
I think that was to an audience of one, and that would be the President of the United States.
Why would that? I would imagine the President goes the wrong way on that one. He wants a guy who's emotional.
Maybe it was to
and
the partisan. Senators?
I don't know. I did it help? I don't think it made any difference because they made the arguments anyway. Honestly,
I think the one thing that sticks with me on this is when he was talking about the conspiracy, left-wing conspiracy that was out to get him in this, and he said, what goes around comes around.
Right.
That worried me for a guy who's going to sit on the Supreme Court.
Yeah. I love the first
I don't want a guy saying, hey, what goes around comes around.
Yeah, I was not, and Ann and I were talking about it earlier, when he said only my law clerk saw this speech. I'm like, well, maybe you should have shown it to somebody.
maybe
you should have an advisor. The tone of it I didn't like, and he's going to get through it, but it opened up an opportunity that the other side shouldn't have.
Right. It also opens up an opportunity for people to require him to recuse himself on cases that involve politics.
But they never recuse themselves.
I know. But they still make the argument.
Yeah.
Then if we don't, we got to believe in some institutions here. We believe in our jury. But we believe in the Supreme Court. We have trouble with our politicians. The Supreme Court has always been something that people believe in. And if they start to question this, that's another one of those institutional pillars that seems to be crumbling. And I worry about that.
You know, and this all started with Bork. And I remember in 2000 when they were doing the Al Gore or the election decision, and a woman said, "Oh, it's all political." And I just, to me, that was so foreign. Mm-hmm. But now I think it hasn't been injected
yes.
into this.
Well, that's true.
Oh, absolutely,
that is true. I mean, it was Bork, and because Bork actually became the guy that we're all afraid is going to happen in Washington.
He became a verb.
He was the guy that when Nixon started firing people, right. He was the guy that accepted the job to fire everybody else and do Nixon's bidding. Which
begs the question, why do you nominate him?
Right. But that's there's just some, it's too much to think about right now. I got a lot. It's a Friday afternoon. We're trying to relax. Now, you know, you think it's stressful on us. Think about, you know, poor Justin Kaufman, who works the morning show, and he's going to be here with his special coming up right after with Andrea Darlis, who's got the news headlines from the newsroom in the WGN Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. What's going on there? All right, Justin Kaufman is
Justin.
To move forward here with the WGN Roundtable in the aftermath of the guilty second-degree murder conviction and 16 counts of aggravated battery, which is quite a wallop there.
Yeah.
And quite a big day.
It's great to see you guys, and you did wonderful work today. And you can find all that stuff at WGNradio.com as we cover a possible watershed moment. That's what we're going to talk about tonight,
mm-hmm.
whether or not it is a watershed moment for the history of Chicago or something that will be referenced in 2 years when the next thing happens.
Yeah, what happens now is a good question,
that's
right?
The question we're going to tackle before Patty and Andrea take the air at 8 o'clock, a special broadcast tonight from 7 to 8. Got a great panel of reporters in the field, community leaders and others joining us. So it's going to be a one-hour special, and then Patty takes over at 8 o'clock.
You got it.
All right, good to see you guys. The Steve Cochran Show celebrates the most valuable person on the planet weekday mornings at 720 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. The news is sponsored by Team Hochberg at Pearl Mortgage.